that rationalizations of living a new life or getting right with herself begin to formulate, not as a result of guilt or conviction per se, but rather as a function of relieving the anxieties associated with the new reality that she will eventually no longer be able to compare effectively in the SMP. The writing's on the wall. Either she must establish her own security and provisioning, or settle for as acceptable a provider as her present looks, personal desirability, and sexual agency will permit to secure a man's long-term provisioning. Men. It may seem dismally pessimistic to begin boys' SMV at so low a starting point at 15. But recall that we're looking at overall averages. A 15-year-old girl will look at an 18 to 20-year-old man's sexual approval as more valuable than that of her same-age peers. It's not that notable boys' attentions are worthless, but they are far more mundane to a mid-teens girl. Thus, the evaluation starts much lower. As men age, you can see that their SMV tends to level off during their 20s, with a gradual rise up to age 30. This represents men's slow-build SMV as they become more valuable by metrics of physical prowess, social gravity, status, maturity, affluence, influence, and, hopefully, dominance. It's a slow process and, unfortunately, of a man's significant maturing to his SMV. Most of it occurs while women are reaching their own SMV peak. At age 23, while a girl is enjoying her prime SMP value, a man is just beginning to make his own gradual ascent. By age 36, the average man has reached his own relative SMV apex. It's at this phase that his sexual, social, professional appeal has reached maturity, assuming he's maximized as much of his potential as possible. It's at this stage that women's hypergamous directives will find him the most acceptable for her long-term investment. He's young enough to retain his physique in better part, but old enough to have attained social and professional maturity. Comparative SMV and the peak span years. One important note here is to compare men and women's SMV decline. Women's SMV, being primarily based on the physical, has a much more precipitous decline than that of men's, whose decline is graduated upon a declining capacity to maintain his status as well as his health or looks. Since a man's SMV is primarily rooted in his personal accomplishment, his SMV degradation has much more potential for preservation. Women's SMV burns hot and short, but men's burns slow and long. Now, class, please address your attention to the critical 15 to 16-year span between a woman's peak SMV and that of men's. It should come as no surprise that this span is generally the most socially tumultuous between the sexes. The majority of first marriages take place here. Single motherhood takes place here. Advanced degrees, career establishments, hitting the wall, and many other significant life events occur in this life stage. So it is with a profound sense of importance that we understand the SMV context and the SMP's influence as prescribed to each sex's experience during this period. At age 30, men are just beginning to manifest some proto-awareness of their inherent sexual value, while simultaneously, women are becoming painfully aware of their marked inability to compete with their sexual competitors indefinitely. This is the point of comparative SMV, when both sexes are situationally at about the same level of valuation. 5. See my website for graph number 5. The conflict in this is that men are just beginning to realize their potential, while women must struggle with the declination of their own. This is the primary phase during which women must cash in their biological chips in the hope that the best men they can invest their hypergamy with will not be so aware of their innate SMV potential that they would choose a younger woman, 22 to 24, during her peak phase over her. I wrote about this later in The Threat. Nothing is more threatening yet simultaneously attractive to a woman than a man who is aware of his own value to women. The confluence between sexes comparative SMV is perhaps the most critical stage of life for feminine hypergamy. She must be able to keep him ignorant of his SMV potential long enough to optimize her hypergamy. The entirety of feminine social influence revolves around optimizing this hypergamy for as long as she is desirable enough to affect it. In men's case, his imperative is to awaken to his SMV, or his potential of it, before he has made life-altering decisions based on a lack of understanding his potential and remaining apart from women's pluralistic sexual strategies to make those life decisions based on his own best interest. Every man who I've ever known to tell me how he wished he'd known of the manosphere, or read my writing before getting married, or accidentally knocking up his girlfriend, has his regret rooted in not making this SMV awareness connection before she had consolidated, legally and emotionally, on her sexual imperatives. They tended to value women more greatly than their own personal potential for a later realized SMV peak. Or they never realized that peak due to not making this awareness connection. Well, I'm afraid that's all I have space for today, class. I hope this brief intensive has given you some food for thought as you enter a feminized world legally and socially dedicated to the benefit of optimizing hypergamy. Just remember, as you see your illustrious manosphere instructors gazing proudly from the gallery in our professorial caps and gowns, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Class dismissed. We are who we say we are.
Chapter 5. Continued. Part 3.
Just be yourself. We are who we say we are. Is the woman who applies makeup every day being herself? How about the woman with implants? Is she being herself? What about the woman wearing high heels because it boosts her height 4 inches? Is the girl you see in nothing but party pics on Facebook being herself? Let's turn it the other way. What of the woman wearing a business suit that emphasizes her shoulders with pads in the jacket? Is she being herself? If she colors her hair, does this make her less genuine? If being ourselves is an idealized state, then I should reasonably be able to expect a like-minded fitness model to be attracted to me, even if my greatest passion is to sit on my couch, eat a large pizza, and wash it down with a six-pack of Michelob while watching Monday Night Football. Right? After all, I am just being myself. It's who I am. Believe, and so you shall become. The hardest distinction the uninitiated have with the JBY, just be yourself, dynamic is that personality is malleable. Personality is always in flux. The person you are today isn't who you were 2 years ago, nor the person you'll be 2 years from now. There are traits and characteristics we may carry with us for a lifetime. But even these are subject to change depending upon circumstance. You define what being yourself is at any given moment, and it's relative to your personal conditions and environment. So where do you draw the line? When does a genuine change of character become legitimate rather than being shallow or superficial or someone you're not? Those are just catch terms that women, and too many chumps, have used with success over the centuries, and men have internalized as being states of perception that women think are undesirable, yet they never accurately define. Rather, they stay intentionally ambiguous and usually relative to an individual woman's interpretation, while their behaviors indicate their own motivations. You are who you believe you are, and you are who she perceives you to be. One of the hardest things for anyone, male or female, to hear is that they need to change their lifestyle. It implies that their just being themselves is in some way at fault for their present conditions. It's analogous to telling someone they're not living their lives correctly or that they're raising their kids wrong. If I have a friend that is shooting heroin and I actively encourage him to stop and make an effort to help him clean up, society calls me a hero or a savior. When I encourage my friend to quit smoking before she gets cancer, I'm a concerned good friend helping my friend with a health risk behavior. But when I tell a friend he needs to change his approach to women, and this is a reason for his unhappiness, and he needs to change his outlook on and approach with women, look better and feel better, then I'm a shallow prick and insensitive to his problem. Worse still is even attempting to offer constructive criticism in as positive a light possible that a person can improve themselves by changing their outlook and modifying their behavior. Personality is not only malleable, but it can change dramatically under specific conditions. An easy example of this are veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. These men were exposed to traumatic environments that fundamentally altered their personalities. While this is an extreme illustration, it shows that becoming a different person is a matter of conditions. If my conditions are such that I enjoy sitting at home eating a whole pizza, washing it down with a six-pack of Budweiser, and watching anime on a Friday evening, can I realistically expect that hot fitness instructor at the gym to come on over and genuinely want to fuck my brains out? And why not? After all, I'm only being myself, and she should love me for who I am, right? If this were my case, the conditions that define my personality are incongruous with attracting and or maintaining a relationship with someone whose conditions are not my own. JBY is an operative social convention that aids hypergamy. Women are only too happy to endorse and reinforce JBY for the conscious reasoning that it sounds like the right thing to say. It's an unassailable position. Who wouldn't want you to be you? If what counts is all on the inside, then anyone telling you to change must be manipulating you for their own selfish reasons. This dovetails nicely into the popularized fat acceptance, self-acceptance mantra most women will fall back on when the impact of the wall begins to manifest itself in their physiques, and they want to be loved for who they are rather than what they used to look like. However, on a subconscious level, the latent purpose of fostering the JBY social convention in men is yet another sexual selection filtering mechanism. Actually, it's more of a filtering failsafe in that by socially mandating a genuineness in the general populace of men, women are more secure in the accuracy of their sexual assessment of men. if all men are just being themselves and are encouraged to be the person they truly are, this then aids a woman in determining which man will best satisfy her hypergamy. As I've stated in many a prior post, women claim to want honesty from men, but no woman wants full disclosure. In a general sense, I advise this because it serves to sustain a man's aura of mystery, only to be progressively discovered by women with the appropriate levels of interest and responsiveness to men. However, another reason to remain deliberately ambiguous is to diffuse the JBY dynamic that women assume would be a man's default psychology. An integral part of maintaining the feminine imperative as a social imperative involves keeping women as the primary sexual selectors. What this means is that a woman's sexual strategy necessitates that she be in as optimized a condition as her capacity, attractiveness, allows for her to choose from the best males available to satisfy that strategy. JBY is a tool in maintaining the feminine imperative as the social imperative. Furthermore, JBY serves in optimizing hypergamy in aiding a woman's sense of security about assessing which man will best suit her hypergamy. Ironically, the JBY dynamic gets upended once a monogamous relationship is established by a woman's anxiety over fixing her partner once in that relationship. What was once the pseudo-genuineness of just him being himself is replaced by, "I'm working on him," in order for him to become the ideal man to meet with her hypergamic approval, thus exposing the calculated nonsense JBY really is to begin with. We are who we say we are. We can alter our own personalities and have them altered by our conditions or any combination of the two. But to suggest that personality is static is a falsehood. The trap is to think that altering personality is in any way disingenuous. There are certainly terrific actors or posers and the like that when we are confronted with them, we sense or even know that they are pushing an envelope that they may not be entirely comfortable with, but there is merit to a fake it till you make it doctrine. We only perceive it as being false, superficial, or as trying to be something you're not when we have a concept or knowledge of a previous set of personality behaviors. If you met a likable, cocky, funny guy at a club this weekend, how are you to know whether he's the real deal or stretching the limits of his personality if you've never met him before? From the 48 Laws of Power. Law 25. Recreate yourself. Do not accept the roles that society foist on you. Recreate yourself by forging a new identity. One that commands attention and never bores the audience. Be the master of your own image rather than letting others define it for you. Incorporate dramatic devices into your public gestures and actions. Your power will be enhanced and your character will seem larger than life. The nice guy jerk spectrum. I know. Nice guy versus jerk has been done into the ground many times. I think one of the easiest targets for game hate is the terminology. It's far too easy to apply subjective definitions to the archetypes like nice guy or jerk. The standard binary response is usually, "So I gotta be a complete asshole all the time or girls won't be attracted to me? Screw that, man. I'm not into game playing." You can sift back through any number of forum pages of advice I've offered and read me over and over again telling young men to get in touch with their inner asshole. However, in any of my posts, never do I state to in fact become an asshole. The two most common questions I get asked advice for is, why do girls love jerks so much? and the how do I get out of the friend zone line. Both of these illustrate different ends of a spectrum. Try to think of it this way. On one end of the spectrum, you have the consummate jerk. He's obnoxious, an asshole, borders on abusiveness. But women flock to the guy in droves. On the opposite end of the scale, we have the ultimate nice guy who does and embodies everything any girl has ever told him he needs to become in order to achieve their intimacy, and has internalized this doormat conditioning into his own personality. This is the guy who'll spend countless hours on the phone being friends with a girl, or spend fortunes on gifts for her in order to buy her approval. I think it's important to look at the roots of the terms jerk and nice guy. Let's not forget that these characterizations exist because women gave them these names and classifications based on their own common evaluations. Women defined these terms. Guys simply made the association with them. We tend to see these as parodies or caricatures now. Abusive wife-beating jerk or doormat nice guy. These are two extreme ends of the spectrum, and when considering them after candid assessment, the mistake becomes falling into a binary all-or-nothing interpretation. So I have to be more of a jerk then? Well, I'm just not like that, says the AFC, frustrated at what seems like women's duplicity of words and actions, but this misses the point. The problem is that if you think of a center point between that jerk and nice guy spectrum, most guys lean towards, if not halfway over to, the nice guy. That's the get in touch with your feminine side, believe women's words instead of actions default for the vast majority of men. This is what women are used to because it is so common. And women only encourage it because it suits their gender's imperative best. The real extreme jerk is as rare as the real extreme nice guy. So it's necessary to look at things in order of degrees in this respect. Most men are betas, or overwhelmingly invest themselves in a beta male identity. They opt for the nice, accommodating, supplicating side of this spectrum. For the majority, they've been socially conditioned to suppress any natural masculine impulse in favor of accommodating and identifying with women's imperatives, or at least what they're led to understand as their imperatives, at the risk of intimate rejection. It's exactly this mindset, this beta male default to the nice end of the spectrum that 85% of guys subscribe to. That makes the guy who leans into the jerk end of the spectrum attractive. Yes, confidence and indifference are alpha traits. But in a world awash in nice guys ready to buy a hot girl a drink, it's the guy who couldn't give a shit who she marks as a sexual potential. It's just this conditioning over the last 50 plus or so years that makes the nice side of the spectrum the default. That doesn't mean all nice guys are pathetic simps without a spine and groveling at the feet of any one itis they happen to attach themselves to. It is to say that, by comparison, and because the overwhelming tendency to go nice is the standard, the guy who leans even marginally to the jerk side of the spectrum becomes at least notable and at best attractive, simply by dissociation from the masses of nice guys. He's attractive on two levels, the first being the rudimentary alpha biological level for a guy who's decisive, in control, confident, and has an attitude of caring less about a woman, since he realizes, to some degree, his value as a commodity comes from his having the options to have such an attitude. The second is that the jerk-leaning guy is a purple cow in a field of bland, colorless, nice cows. He's notable, and this too makes him a male worthy of female competition. which then reinforces his sense of having options. He's not an abuser. He's not a manipulator per se, but he tends to put himself before and above, sometimes innocently, sometimes callously, the women who are attracted to him. Now, the irony of all of this is that the AFC thinks that this situation is in reverse. He believes that nice guys are the anomaly in a sea of jerks. Of course he believes this because it's all his female friends talk about. They're jerk BFs and how nice they are for being good listeners. So his self-image gets validated and he believes he's unique and valuable for being not like other guys, and his patience and sensitivity will eventually pay off. Which it very well could once the object of his obsession has had her fun and possibly bred with the bad boy. A new world jerk order. Another criticism leveled at Game is a fear that nominally nice guys will take this lesson to heart and become a new social wave of intolerable assholes. The fear is a new generation of arrogant pricks not being themselves all in order to hook up. I understand the fear of a mass of men radically leaning their personalities towards the jerk end of the spectrum as prompted by the PUA or MRA, men's rights activist communities. Let me be the first to say, those fears are unfounded. Guys don't search out the community, blogs, or forums because they're getting too much pussy from being archetypal nice. In fact, the observation that more, shall we say, self-centered men seem to be getting laid most consistently is so prevalent that there's an entire section dedicated to it on the main So Suave webpage. This leads me to believe that a sudden paradigm shift to jerkness isn't remotely the threat that anyone should fear. Nice guys, by definition, have a real tough time effectively pulling off acting like a jerk, much less genuinely converting their personalities to that of a jerk. Most men would prefer to inch toward the jerk end of the spectrum, if at all, and assuming they come to believing things aren't as they previously believed. The more common mindset for beta males is to expect that women should appreciate them for being the nice, dependable, self-sacrificing guy that every woman since his mother has told him he should be. It's far easier to believe that the world should change for you than to accept the truth you need to improve yourself to get the things you want. It's the lazy man's path to disqualify or cheapen things that he desperately wants, but lacks the motivation to change himself to get. So the hot, quality girl he wanted before becomes the trashy club slut after she rejects him. The real quality girl should love, desire him unconditionally for who he is, rather than force him into improving himself. Which in this instance means he ought to become the caricatured jerk archetype he's been taught to hate. Most people resist becoming what they hate, even if it's a change for the better. We ought to worry less about social implications of converting nice guys into jerks than making them self-aware to begin with. The risk of creating a bona fide jerk in such an effort is a decent trade-off. Beta Game. Before I launch into this proper, let me define a few terms in the fashion that I interpret them. With the popularity of the Manosphere and a few notable blogs, there's been a new push with regards to using the terms alpha and beta and sometimes omega when describing certain classifications of males in modern culture. Allow me to go on record as viewing these ideas as mindsets, whereas terms such as being an AFC or alpha are really states of being. For instance, a contextual alpha can be the master of his professional realm and still be an AFC with regards to women. A beta male can still be as wealthy and astute in status as his conditions and fortune have placed him in, often by circumstance. Some states necessitate certain mindsets. A positive masculine state requires an alpha mindset. Others do not. Also, don't make the mistake of associating success, personal and career, with an alpha mindset. There are plenty of alphas on hotchickswithdouchebags.com. However, that doesn't necessarily make them well-rounded individuals. I tend to think of the ideas alpha and beta as subconscious states or attitudes that manifest themselves in our thoughts, beliefs, and actions. Beta game. With this in mind, I'd like to propose the idea of beta game. Since we're using the alpha and beta terminology here, it's important to grasp where it comes from. Anyone with a cursory understanding about animal social hierarchies knows the principle of alpha and beta individuals within a social collective. Alphas tend to be the males who exhibit the best genetic characteristics and behavioral skills that put them at the top of the potential breeding pool. In fact, betas are rarely mentioned as such in scientific studies. There are alphas, and there's the rest of the pack or collective. The beta term in PUA lingo is really something of a novelty. Relating these terms to human social interactions, while at times a subjective stretch, isn't too hard to understand the basic representative concepts. We can see the similarity and the applications in long-term and short-term breeding methodologies in the wild that mirror our own. Like any other beta animal, alternate methodologies had to be developed in order to facilitate human breeding under the harsh conditions of alpha competition. In essence, and as found in the wild, beta males have developed, evolved, methods which attempt to poach potential females from an alpha's harem, or at least in this case, his perceived potential harem. Identification. Beta male game focuses primarily on betas identifying and assimilating themselves to be more like the women they hope to connect with. But it goes beyond this. The methodology dictates that the beta be perceived as being unique, or at least set apart, from the more common alpha males whom his desired women naturally prefer. This is the beginning of the not like other guys mental schema he hopes to evoke in his idealized woman. Due to his inability to compete with an alpha competitor in the physical, he must fight an uphill psychological battle in his own terms. This involves convincing his target that her best parental investment should be with him, as per her stated requirements, as he more closely embodies her long-term prerequisites. The beta likens himself to her and self-models himself in accord with feminine imperatives in an effort to maximize his compatibility and familiarity with her and the feminine. This identification process is further reinforced through the feminine social conventions he subscribes to. Feminine society, both beta men and women, indirectly reward him for more closely assimilating to its ideal. Be more like an archetypal woman. Sensitive, empathetic, emotional, security-seeking, etc. Not only this, but take de facto feminine offense when presented with anything to the contrary of a female positive perspective. Lift women up, become less so they become more, and in reciprocation she's more apt to breed with the beta. That's the principle, not necessarily the reality. In some ways, it's a Captain Save-A-Ho mentality written on a grand scale. The fallacy in this, of course, is the presumption that like should attract like. Beta men fail to understand that opposites attract. And barring the notable exceptions, most women don't want to marry other women. Least of all, a carbon copy of themselves. Disqualification. When presented with a competitor of superior status, both sexes' innate, subconscious reaction is to disqualify that competitor from breeding in as expedient a method as possible. For animals, this usually involves some kind of courtship performance or outright competitive hostility. While the same could be said for human beings, our natural social impulse requires we take a bit more tact. Look at that girl. She must be a slut to wear or act like that. Or, yeah, he's pretty good looking, but guys like that are usually fags, are an example of the standard social weapons people use to disqualify their respective sex. Disqualify the competitor on the most base level. Question their sexuality. Literally cast doubt on a competitor's sexual fitness to breed with potential mates. While most men, alpha or beta, will make similar attempts to disqualify, the beta's methodology ties back into his need for feminine identification in his disqualifying a competitor. Essentially, he relies on feminine ways of disqualification by drawing upon his likeness to the women he hopes to emulate, thus, he believes, furthering potential attraction through an opportunity to prove how well he identifies with the feminine. The competitor may not be gay, but he must be cast as inferior to the beta himself due to his competitor's inability or lessened ability to identify and empathize with his desired female as well as he does. With alpha competitors, the field has already been plowed for him by feminine social conventions. All he need do is plant the seeds. The fact that the alpha tends to embody the masculine opposite of what he's embraced also feeds this drive. His belief is that women aren't attracted to the macho tough guy. They want a man who's kind and thoughtful, a good listener. So the natural recourse is to amplify this disparity. The alpha is a 1950s Neanderthal throwback. He's bitter. He's a misogynist. He's a child in a man's body with a fragile ego only interested in fucking women and moving on. He's unlike anything on women's collective, stated, list of prerequisites for an acceptable male. He must be ridiculed, as all women ridicule, for his selfish, overt, hypermasculinity. Furthermore, the beta needs to make the alpha seem common, while making himself seem unique. In order to effectively disqualify an alpha, the beta has to display his empathy for the feminine, and she must appreciate it or it's all been for nothing, which it usually is. Not only is this an ego preservation mechanism, but it's also perceived as a tool for achieving the desired sexual reciprocation appreciation he desires. Interpretation. All of this really just scratches the surface of how beta game has evolved. I will add that all of these methods come back to a common root. The need to breed under the duress of competition. Most of what I've gone into here, and primarily the feminine identity association, become ego invested and internalized over the course of a lifetime. It gets to the point that under the auspices of relative anonymity, like the internet, that the beta will still cling to his mental model, even in the face of a very rational, empirical evidence that contradicts the effectiveness of his game, for no other reason than that a woman, a potential mate with whom he could identify, might read his post and may become attracted to him. The game is never dropped for him, even in light of proving his errors. Beta game is like the boy who decides to play on the girls' team when a boys versus girls kickball game is started. He thinks it will endear himself to them, when all it really does is make him another girlfriend to giggle with.
Chapter 5 Continued Part 4
Everyone has a game in some respect. The validity of that game may be more or less effective. But at some point, a man is going to adapt to a methodology of seduction as per his conditions and environment warrant. Even Master PUAs still need to adapt their game for differing environments. Different clubs, types of women, socioeconomic levels, countries, etc. There needs to be adaptation and improvisation. The same applies for betas, but the disparity is that the beta tends to think of a one-size-fits-all approach. For all the complaints of worry about the game community turning into scripted social robots, it's actually the beta who adopts a far more embedded script and is less likely to variate from it. Betas tend to stick with what worked for them, what was reinforced for them in the past. The pheromonal beta.
You choke the chicken before any big date, don't you?
Anyone who's seen the movie Something About Mary is pretty familiar with the now classic hair gel incident.
Dumb.
You choke the chicken before any big date, don't you?
Tell me you spanked the monkey before any big date.
Oh my God, he doesn't flog the dolphin before a big date. Are you crazy? That's like going out there with a loaded gun. Of course that's why you're nervous. Oh my dear friend, please, sit, please.
Look, after you've had sex with a girl and you're lying in bed with her, are you nervous?
No, you're not.
Why?
Ted.
'Cause I'm tired.
Dumb.
Wrong. It's because you ain't got the baby batter on the brain anymore. Jesus, that stuff will fuck your head up.
Look, the most honest moment in a man's life are the few minutes after he's blown his load. Now that is a medical fact. And the reason for it is that you're no longer trying to get laid. You're thinking like a girl. And girls love that.
Even if you've never seen the film, it's likely you're at least peripherally aware of the beta game principle Dom is explaining here. Can you spot the inconsistency? You're thinking like a girl, and girls love that. No, they don't. Sorry, Dom, they want a loaded gun. Desexualization as game is one of the primary mistakes betas make. This is the Something About Mary effect. The presumption that your biological impulse to desire sex is a hindrance to getting sex. From a rational standpoint, this is ridiculous. But betas eat this idea up because it dovetails nicely into their misguided sexual conditioning that assumes like attracts like. Identify more with the feminine to be more attractive to the feminine. Watching this movie is like an effort in deconstructing all the beta game tenets of the past 40 years. I apologize for not having the sources to cite for this, but I can remember reading case studies on the biochemical effect of human sexual interaction doing grad work in college. Update. Links to these studies can be found at therationalmail.com. I believe they were done by Dr. Marty Hasselton. But they outlined the chemical endorphin and hormonal profiles present in healthy adults' bloodstreams while in various phases of attraction, arousal, pre-sex and post-sex interaction between couples. The most dramatic one to look up are the similarities in the chemical properties of dopamine and heroin for people experiencing love or infatuation. Even more fascinating are the effects hormones play on portions of men's brains when assessing sexual cues in a potential sex partner. Healthy testosterone levels literally cause men to perceive women as sexual objects, stimulating the same portions of our brains used for cognitive problem solving and manipulating tools. However, testosterone is mitigated by oxytocin, the hormone secreted just post-orgasm. While testosterone is responsible for sex drive and aggressive impulses, not to mention muscular development, deepening of voice, and hair growth, oxytocin is linked to feelings of nurturing, trust, and comfort. Oxytocin is believed to be a primary influence in post-sex and post-pregnancy emotional attachment in women who produce the hormone in much higher amounts than men. Postpartum depression is speculated to be a withdrawal symptom triggered by the decrease in oxytocin and progesterone in post-birth women. The effect of post-orgasm oxytocin in men is similar to women. However, in men, it also serves as a buffering agent to heighten dopamine and testosterone levels. Oxytocin plays a critical part in regulating a man's testosterone levels. Just post-orgasm, the human body flushes oxytocin into the bloodstream to balance out the endorphin and dopamine high of sexual arousal. While this hormone promotes feelings of trust and comfort in men, it also serves to calm the guy down sexually. Oxytocin is a testosterone buffer in men, thus resulting in you going limp for a while after busting a nut. From an evolutionary perspective, this makes sense in that it ensures the sperm deposited stays in a woman's vagina, thus increasing fertility odds, instead of being shoveled out by a still erect penis. Not only that, but oxytocin serves to promote peer bonding in that it fosters feelings of protective trust in men. Oxytocin discharge in humans is also triggered by pheromonal and environmental prompts, touch or kino, for instance. In addition to all of this, there's the role that pheromones play in regard to sexual attraction and arousal. You can Google these, but there are several pheromonal studies that indicate that men with differing scents from those of women tend to attract opposite scents in women. From an evolutionary perspective, the conclusion drawn is that people of similar genus or genotype, i.e. blood-related family members, will be less aroused sexually by persons of their own genotype, thus ensuring biodiversity, nature's prevention plan against inbreeding. However, in the same sweaty t-shirt studies, the perspiration of men with higher testosterone levels were deemed more sexually viable or arousing by women than men with lower T levels, and particularly so for women in the proliferative phase of their menstrual cycles. You can attribute whatever legitimacy you want to studies like this, but the evidence points to higher testosterone levels as playing an influential part in sexual attraction. Also, bear in mind that pheromones influence women living in close proximity to each other to synchronize their menstrual cycles. Another evolutionary mechanism believed to ensure fertility and communal support for social animals. The pheromonal beta. From a biomechanical perspective, the indication is that men who consistently masturbate are essentially broadcasting their status as pheromonal betas. And women's biochemical mechanics subconsciously register this about them. Higher testosterone males manifest their sexual viability in both sexual assertiveness and scent. If you are chronically depleted of testosterone and or subjected to the calming effects of oxytocin, your sexual viability is at a disadvantage. In fact, from an evolutionary standpoint, the beta males of our feral hunter-gatherer beginnings would be more prone to masturbation as a sexual release since, theoretically, they would have had less access to breeding opportunities than alpha males. It would then follow that definitive subconscious behavioral and chemical cues would evolve to aid females in selecting the best mate for parental investment. So, For as much as beta guys would like to have you believe that snapping your radish before a date will improve your chances of fucking the girl, odds are you're shooting yourself in the foot. This stupid belief is rooted in the something about Mary myth that women don't want an overly sexualized man. But the biological truth is far from that. The myth is that women need to be comfortable with a guy in order to sleep with him. So men will actively desexualize themselves in order to comply. However, all indications point to a need for sexual anxiety and tension in arousal to prompt sexual intercourse. Comfort and trust are post-orgasm conditions. Anxiety, arousal, and sexual urgency are pre-orgasm conditions, and both have their own unique hormonal signatures. Disclaimer. And now for the disclaimer. I'm not an endocrinologist, biochemist, or physician. I'll admit this is a working conjecture, but it's plausible conjecture. For the record, it's not about less desirable pheromones. It's about lower incidence of any sex cue pheromones due to depletion and the behaviors that depletion prompts. It stands to reason that women would be more attracted to men motivated to being sexual with them, manifesting this in chemistry and behavior, than sexually unmotivated men manifesting signs of disinterest. I used to think that the primary issue with beating off was this feminine double standard. Women masturbating is sexy, arousing, and nowadays, socially empowering. For men, masturbation is a perversion. It implies an inability to be man enough to fuck a real woman. Whacking off is failure for a man, but empowerment for a woman. Why would this social condition exist, and what is its latent function? I still see the double standard in all that, and while I think it's valid, it kind of only brushes the surface of self-pleasure from a social convention perspective. Sigmund Freud once said, "All energy is sexual," meaning that subliminally we will redirect our motivation for ungratified sexual impulse to other endeavors. Thus, it's men, being the sex with the highest amount of libido-inducing testosterone, who must look for more outlets to transfer this motivation to than women. So is it any real surprise that it's historically men who've primarily been the empire builders, the conquerors, the creators, and destroyers who've, for better or worse, moved humanity the most significantly? Masturbation diffuses this impulse. It kills that drive, or at least sublimates it. So wouldn't it stand to reason that a global social convention that shames men for masturbation would be beneficial to a society interested in expanding? Thus the cultural meme becomes men who jack off are losers, and men who don't thereby prove their sexual viability. Because if they're not beating off, they must be fucking women semi-regularly for sexual release, and become motivated to redirect that impulse to the betterment of themselves and or society. Dread Games. The original huff amongst women in the manosphere about dread came in the wake of a post about instilling a sense of dread in a woman in order to help maintain a consistent frame control in a relationship. Naturally, women's unconditioned response to this overt assertion of control was to demonize the whole idea of dread. When you think about it, dread, as proposed, is really a sense of conceptualizing the potential outcome of losing the intimacy of a partner and the resulting fallout. Emotional, financial, familial, personal, etc. from that loss. Such an overt declaration for promoting a sense of dread conjures melodramatic images of fiendish men
blackmailing their women into emotional enslavement to their possessive and insecure whims. I think what's lost amongst all this sensationalism about dread, a very weak term for the concept, is the applicability dread has in a much broader scope, and particularly for women, than the overtly dramatic characterization of it when men openly discuss using it themselves. Faces of Dread. I have a good friend, John, who's just this side of 37. I love the guy, but John's not much to look at. At around 30, he essentially gave up on himself. He got married far too young on the business end of a do-the-right-thing accidental pregnancy. And from a personal standpoint, that was the end of his window of opportunity to explore any other options he may have had. His wife let herself go just after the second pregnancy, ballooned into a beach ball, and he followed suit. In actuality, it wouldn't take much for him to get back on top of his game, but he has no desire to. Now, after detailing John's situation, you might think he'd be the last candidate to participate in anything resembling a manipulation of dread in a relationship. And you'd be right. But he and guys like him are often the unwilling participants in their wives' or girlfriends' own dread games. Although John isn't going to spontaneously attract women with either his looks or due to his complete obliviousness to game, he is an exceptional provider for his family. He regularly busts his ass as a programmer and is the sole breadwinner of the family, single-handedly funding his wife's schooling. In addition, he's a very attentive father, husband, and is somewhat of a handyman around the house. In spite of all of this, his wife tends to be a bit of a shrew, browbeating him on a regular basis, which has been passed on to the personalities of his teenage daughters, who engage in the same heavy-handedness their mother does. Yet for all the passive-aggressive derision, John's wife is easily one of the most possessive women I've ever known. He literally lives in a constant state of surveillance as to his whereabouts. She calls to verify he is where he says he is and continually suspects him of running off to a strip club, which to my knowledge, he's never set foot inside one or engaging in any way with another woman. It's gotten to the point that it's comical to think that she'd have any worry that he'd be snatched away by a better woman. But there it is. The dreaded competition anxiety, prompting unease in an albeit low self-esteem, woman with no realistic possibility of it ever occurring. I can't compete with that. Some of the most possessive women I've ever known have been the girlfriends and wives of amateur circuit bodybuilders. Most of these girls, even the fitness competitors, had to either be very self-assured or they resorted to controlling tactics and possessiveness due to the constant reminder of how desired their men were by other women. Even when that was explicitly not the case, the perception of their desirability was enough to bring this out in them. They had the love and desire of very physically elite men, but this still wasn't enough to pacify that innate sense of dread. Manosphere blogger Dalrog has blogged ad infinitum about the feminized notion of how a man's viewing, using, porn is conflated with adultery by wives. To say nothing about the constant push to pathologize the male sexual response, this is an easy out for women following the eat, pray, love script, wanting to exit a marriage with cash and prizes. However, the fundamental point in that conflation is a woman's, often overstated, inability to compete with the porn star ideal of physical perfection and sexual acrobatics that no normal woman could ever be comfortable with. Considering the sheer variety of men's sexual appetites, this is ludicrous on the surface of it. But it is illustrative of the predominance dread plays in women's psyches.
It doesn't matter what the particulars of his sexual appetites are. She feels inadequate in that competition and fears a loss of intimacy. Dread games. I catch a lot of hostility from the femosphere for even suggesting a man directly foster competition.